few minutes ago we read from Hebrews chapter 11. We've been working through this chapter on Sunday mornings. This morning is week number 10 on this chapter. What's the chapter about? Somebody under the age of 10. What's the chapter about in one word? Meg? The chapter is about faith. It's here to stir us up to have faith and to exercise faith and to grow in faith. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. That's what the writer says. If you want to please God, if you want to know God, if you want to be accepted by God, if you want to live your life in the presence of God, if you want to have everlasting life from God, then what you need is faith, the sort of faith that this chapter talks about. So what is faith? That's the question with which we've started every week. What is faith? The writer explains in verse 1 what he means by faith. He says, faith is, point 1, being sure of what we hope for. There are things that we hope for, things that we're looking forward to, things that lie in the future. Things you can't have now, but which God has promised he's going to bring about. And faith means being sure of those things and living accordingly. If we're Christians, what are we looking forward to? What are we hoping for? We're looking forward to Jesus Christ coming again. We're expecting the sky to open one of these days. We're expecting to see Jesus descend from heaven, blazing in glory, with a huge army of angels, bringing back with him the souls of all his people who have died all down through the centuries. And we're expecting the bodies of those dead believers, those sleeping believers, to be raised again. And we and they are going to be caught up to meet the Lord Jesus and then to escort him back to earth. And we're expecting Jesus to judge the world, every man, woman, every child who's ever lived. We're expecting him to cast out from the universe all who love evil, all who have never believed in him and surrendered to him. And then we're expecting him to remake the universe, to melt this world down, and then to form it again. And we're expecting the new world to be beautiful, glorious, beyond imagination. A world where we'll always be discovering new joys, new delights, new thrills. And we're expecting Jesus himself, the God-man, to live among us and to share his everlasting life with us. We're expecting to be filled with God himself forever. We're expecting to enjoy God with an enjoyment that gets deeper and richer as eternity unfolds. That's what we're looking forward to. And faith means being sure of those things. Sure of what we're hoping for. Faith means that the thought of that glorious future has gripped our hearts. It's gripped our minds. We're sure of it. We're expecting it. And so we live our lives day by day differently from all the people who don't share our hope. That's faith. Point one. Faith is being sure of what we hope for. And then faith point two, still in verse one, he says, faith means being certain of what we don't see. There are things we don't see, things we can't see, but they're real. God himself is real. The infinite, all-powerful, ever-present God is real, with us, around us, before us, behind us, controlling everything that happens, planning every detail of history, ordering every detail of our lives, working everything together for His own glory and for our good. He's the ultimate reality. He's more real, He's more important than all the visible things, all the tangible things. He's more real than the galaxies. He's more real than the sun and the moon and the earth. He's more real than the mountains and the oceans. He's more real than the kings and the presidents. More real than the crowds. More real than my family. More real than my friends. More real than my enemies. He's more real than my house, than my car, my furnishings. All those things have a beginning and they'll have an end, but He's the everlasting God. He's without beginning, He's without end, He simply is. And faith means being certain of Him, being certain of the invisible God, being certain of His power, His wisdom, His presence, His control, His love for His people. It means we're certain about the Holy Spirit, the invisible presence of God within us. We're certain about heaven, the invisible realm where God dwells. We're certain about the angels, the invisible messengers whom He sends to carry through His plans. We're certain about the invisible war He's fighting against the forces of evil. We're certain about the invisible communications that go on between heaven and earth. We're certain that He's listening to our prayers. We're certain that He's acting on our prayers. We're conscious, we're certain that beyond this world, this visible, tangible, measurable world, the world that you can view through telescopes and analyze in laboratories, there's another world, an invisible world. And again, because we're certain of these things, we live our lives differently from the people who think that this visible world is all there is. We live trusting and serving and obeying and glorifying the invisible God. So faith means being sure of future things which God has promised. And faith means being certain of this invisible God and the realm where He dwells. Now, every real Christian has that faith. If you're a real Christian at all, then you are sure of future things and you are certain of invisible things. And your life is shaped by those certainties. And yet it's true that some Christians have stronger faith than others. You meet one Christian for whom the thought of the future utterly fills his mind, dominates his whole horizon. Every hour of every day he's looking for God's purposes to unfold. And he's conscious that every day brings him closer to the return of Christ. Every Sabbath that passes, he says, that's one less before and the return of Jesus. He's just not interested in the things of this world. He's not interested in money, in possessions, in success, in popularity. He's obsessed with the world to come. And he really is conscious from morning to night of the nearness of God. He lives his whole life conscious that he's under the eye of God. So he fears nothing except God. And he's driven by the thought of pleasing God alone. I don't know if you've met Christians like that. Christians who are full of faith, obsessed with the future and the invisible. But there are also Christians, aren't there, whose faith is a much weaker, a much more fragile thing. Yes, when they stop to think about it, the world to come does seem wonderful. And yes, that does put things into perspective for them. The trouble is they don't often stop to think about it. And yes, when they turn off the TV and when they put away the shopping catalogue, then God does seem very real and very important. The trouble is they don't put those things away very often. So the thought of the future, the thought of God, doesn't dominate their life in the same way. Maybe there was a time when you were living by faith, when the thought of the future, the thought of the invisible God did dominate you and drive you and motivate you and thrill you. Maybe that faith has actually declined for you. Maybe it's been squeezed out by the thought of this world, this present world, this visible world. I think it was like that for the first readers of this letter. We talked about them last week. Well, this chapter was written to stir them up to rebuild their faith, to practice their faith, to train their faith, to live by their faith. And this chapter is here to do the same for us. If our faith is flagging, if we're becoming this worldly, then this chapter is here to stir us up. And we've seen that the way that the writer stirs us up is by giving us this long list of men and women from Old Testament times, who even before the coming of Jesus were living by faith. Shows us these men and women who were driven by the thought of the future and the invisible. Now think about some of the people that the writer talks about. People we've already talked about in the last 9 studies. Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. All of these were people who showed real faith, powerful faith, active faith. But what strikes me is that they fall into 2 groups. In the first group, I would put people whose great challenge was to put faith into practice in their own lives. Abel was in that group, wasn't he? The great thing that Abel did by faith was to bring a sacrifice, the sacrifice God had commanded, a sacrifice to atone for sin. Enoch again was in that group. The great thing Enoch did by faith was simply to walk with God. In an age of unparalleled wickedness, Enoch maintained a steady, daily relationship of friendship with God. By faith, Abraham left his home in Ur and became a father and offered up Isaac. Those were basically choices Abraham had to make for himself by faith. And we're called to exercise that sort of faith every day. Believing in the future, believing in the invisible, drives us to make choices for ourselves that we wouldn't otherwise make. Deciding that you'll be honest and truthful with officials, even when it means that you lose out financially, that's an act of faith. Deciding that you'll turn down a job because it involves Sunday working is an act of faith. Deciding to be baptized, even though you're shy and self-conscious and you don't know what other people will make of it, it's an act of faith. You're making choices for yourself. But then the people in the second group had a further challenge. They not only had to make choices for themselves, they also had to motivate others. They had to persuade and lead other people to follow their example. There was something of that for Noah, wasn't there? Verse 7, "And by faith Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family." He had to persuade his family to break off from their lives here in this world and to go into that giant boat when there was no sign of rain, no hint of floods. That took faith. Joseph verse 22, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. It wasn't enough for Joseph personally to believe in the future and the invisible. He had to persuade his fellow Israelites to believe in those things too, and to act on it. He had to persuade them to take up his bones and to transport them to the promised land. Do you see what I'm saying? The first duty God has given believers to perform is simply to live by faith, to live in his presence day by day, to serve him, to obey him, to make choices that honour him. And if each of us was stranded on a desert island, if each of us was a solitary Robinson Crusoe, that would be our only duty. But we're not. We're in contact with other people constantly. And that means that we have a duty to move them by faith. Just as Noah worked for the salvation of his family and persuaded them to enter the ark, by faith you're working and praying and seeking to influence your family to come to Christ for salvation. By faith you're trying to influence workmates and neighbours and friends. You want them in the ark. By faith you're trying to set an example to your fellow church members. You're trying to stir them up. You're trying to encourage them. Chapter 3, verse 13 of this letter. Encourage one another daily, as long as it's called today. Or chapter 10, verse 24, let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds. Let's not give up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but let's encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. Do you see, a Christian is supposed to live thinking about the day of Christ's return, the day of judgment. A Christian's supposed to live by faith. But part of that is that he's constantly, every day, says the writer, trying to encourage his fellow believers. And the writer means what he says. Encourage one another daily, he says. Which word don't you understand? Daily means daily. If you're a Christian, there should never be one day when you're not in contact with one or another of your fellow Christians, encouraging them. That's part of the life of faith, he says. Do you understand the point we're making? Faith, yes, it's to do with your personal walk with God. It's to do with the choices that you make in your own life. And for some of you at the present time, that's where the main challenge is. The choices you have to make, and you have to make them in faith. But faith is also to do with encouraging others. It's to do with motivating others. And none of us can escape that challenge as well. We spent the last couple of weeks talking about Moses. And we focused on the personal choices Moses had to make. Do you remember in verse 24? By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be ill-treated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. That was a personal choice that Moses had to make. Do I want to carry on living as a prince in Egypt, or do I want to belong to Christ, to the Messiah, when he comes? Moses did his arithmetic. If I choose Egypt, then I get luxuries. I get comfort. I get power. I get prestige here in this world. If I choose Christ, then I face disgrace, humiliation, trouble here in this world. And we know what Moses chose. He said, I've got to have Christ. He's more important than all the treasures of this world. That was the greatest decision of Moses' life. That was the decision that was going to shape everything from there on. I'd rather have Jesus than silver or gold. I'd rather have him than have riches untold. Jesus, I my cross have taken, all to leave and follow thee. Destitute, despised, forsaken, thou from hence my all shall be. A once for all choice to be a disciple of Christ, to turn from the world to Christ. That was Moses' first great choice. But then last week we looked at the continuing choices that Moses had to make for himself. He left Egypt, says the writer, verse 27. Not fearing the king's anger, he persevered because he saw him who is invisible. Moses carried on confronting Pharaoh in his palace. You remember how he goes back into the palace again and again, daring to challenge Pharaoh to his face, demanding that Pharaoh let the Israelites go. Huge faith for Moses to put himself into the firing line again and again and again. He couldn't have done it if he hadn't been 100% sure that the invisible God was with him. He couldn't have done it if he hadn't been 100% sure that God's promises for the future are 100% reliable. But there was that faith, and so he persevered, says the writer. So the writer's told us about those two ways in which Moses' faith was shown. Firstly, the choice he made to have Christ rather than all the treasures of Egypt. And then secondly, the determination to persevere, to keep going back to the palace, facing Pharaoh's anger again and again. But now in verse 28, I want you to see the next challenge for Moses' faith. It was this: by faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. You would think, you might think, that there couldn't be anything harder to ask from Moses than what he's already done. To go back again and again into the palace. But there was, or at least I think, that what he was asked to do next was harder. Moses now had to persuade a whole nation to adopt God's way, to obey God's commands, to believe God's promises, to take God's way of escape. The Authorized Version says at the beginning of verse 28, Moses kept the Passover. And the NIV has followed the AV at that point. But both translations miss the point. It's not just that Moses kept the Passover. The writer says Moses made the Passover. Or rather, Moses has made the Passover, is what he actually wrote, because it was still being observed when this chapter was written. He's saying it was Moses who instituted the Passover. Moses didn't invent it, God invented it. But it was Moses who actually had to put it in place. Moses had to persuade hundreds of thousands of Israelites to hold the Passover feast for the first time. And then he had to ensure that it was kept every year from then on down through the centuries. It was Moses who made the Passover, says the writer. Now you remember the story. Moses has gone to Pharaoh again and again and again. Moses has warned him about this whole series of terrible plagues that are going to fall on Egypt. And the last time, Pharaoh has just erupted in rage and told Moses that if he ever sees him again, Moses will be dead. And Moses leaves. But before he leaves, he tells Pharaoh what God is going to do. This is what the Lord says. About midnight, I am going to go throughout Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die, from the firstborn son of Pharaoh who sits on the throne to the firstborn son of the slave girl who's at her handmill. And Moses tells Pharaoh, you'll be begging me then. I'm begging all the Israelites to leave Egypt. Moses passes on that message which God has given him. The Lord is going to go through the whole land, and the firstborn son from every family is going to die. Pharaoh's the first to hear that warning from Moses, and Pharaoh doesn't believe it. But then Moses has to go to the Israelites, and Moses has to tell them the same message. He has to give them the same warning. He has to warn them that they face the same dreadful judgment. And he has to persuade them that there is only one way that they can escape the judgment. Moses tells them, you must take a lamb, one for each household. You must all slaughter your lambs on the same evening, the 14th day of this month. You must all take the blood, dip a sprig of hyssop in it, then sprinkle the blood around the doorway. And then you must roast the body of the lamb. And after nightfall, you must eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. And you must eat it standing, already dressed for a journey, with your sandals on your feet, all your possessions packed. And while you're eating that lamb, the Lord will be moving through the land. He'll be destroying the firstborn, the hope of every family. But he'll pass over your homes. When he sees the blood around the doorway, he'll pass over your families. You'll be spared. And before the night is out, the Egyptians will be begging you to leave the country. And you must go. You must leave your homes that very night. You must set out for the promised land without delay. That's the message Moses had to preach to the Israelites. Those were the things he had to persuade them to do. That's what it means when it says that he instituted the Passover. Firstly, Moses had to persuade them that the danger was real. It's hard to persuade people of danger, isn't it? It's hard to make them really aware of how great a danger is so that they do something about it. I watched a documentary recently about the towns that lie around Vesuvius. You know, the volcano and the towers over the Bay of Naples in Italy. The people who live in Naples know that that mountain has erupted catastrophically in the past. It still belches out smoke at intervals. They walk up sometimes to the crater and they look down and they see the molten lava seething within it. And they've been urged again and again and again to take some steps to prepare for the next time that it explodes. But they won't. You know, there's no way even that the roads that lead out of Naples could ever cope with a flood of traffic. If people had to evacuate the city, there's no way that the roads could cope. They'd all be trapped in the maze of little streets of that city. If that mountain blows up again, tens of thousands of people at least are going to die. But they can't be persuaded to move. They can't be persuaded to take even basic precautions. Doesn't matter how often the scientists tell them, look, it's coming. You can't make them feel their danger. We've seen in the last 48 hours, haven't we? The utter tragedy that comes because people won't believe in danger until it happens. Just drive at high speed into the fog on the motorway. How many times have people been warned? It's so hard to make people realize that danger's imminent, that disaster's on the way. They don't see the signs of it. They've driven that stretch of motorway hundreds of times before. Nothing's gone wrong in the past. We'll get through again. There had been 10 plagues already, and they'd never affected the Israelites. When the hail came, it never struck their fields. When the cattle of Egypt died, theirs had survived. Well, can you imagine the Israelites saying, well, why will it be any different next time? We never had to take any special precautions in the past and we were safe enough. What's so different about this time? Somehow Moses has to make them believe that they really are in terrible danger. He's got to make them so vividly aware of it that they'll be prepared to break off whatever they're doing, whatever other priorities they've got, and gather in their homes that night to take shelter from the disaster that's coming. How's Moses going to communicate that to hundreds of thousands of Israelites? You're in danger! But he's got to. And then Moses has to persuade them, secondly, that there is only one way of escaping from the danger. A bloody sacrifice. A slaughtered lamb. A substitute dying in their place. Blood round the doorposts. How strange. God's never done anything like this before. Why should this be the chosen way to shield them from disaster? Again, people don't want to take advice, do they? People are always sure that they know a better way. People go to the doctor and he tells them that they need such and such a treatment. But they always know better, don't they? He's had 6 years of training. He's had 20 years of experience. But they've read a really convincing article on the web. Or their friend Fiona told them that using such and such a concoction worked wonders for her. Or they've just got this instinctive feeling that such and such will work better. And when they go back to the doctor 3 months later and he says, well, has the treatment worked? They say, oh, well, I never tried it. That's the frustration that you medics are going to have to face. Moses has to convince these people that there is only one way. They have to be sheltered by blood. The sacrifice has to be made and they have to be covered by that sacrifice. There's nowhere else that they can be sheltered from the disaster that's coming. And then thirdly, Moses has to persuade them that they've got to leave Egypt. And they've got to leave that night. Oh yes, they've been talking about it for ages. They've been miserable in Egypt, haven't they? They've dreamed of getting out of Egypt. But this is all very sudden. Can it really be that urgent? Some of them, no doubt, have got all sorts of plans for the future. If they pack up that night, their plans will never be realized. Some of them own property, land, businesses. Well, they'd assume that if they left Egypt, they'd have time to sell those things. But if we go on the 14th, we're going to lose everything we saved. Some of them maybe are planning their weddings. Are you telling us we've got to cancel them? After all these months of preparation? Some of them maybe are women 9 months pregnant. Surely Moses isn't telling them that they've got to go that very night. Couldn't they wait until the baby's been born? You know, it's one thing, isn't it? Perhaps what they had imagined, an orderly transition over a period of months or years. That could be done without too much sacrifice. It could be done without too much hardship. But here's Moses saying to them, no, no, it has to be that night. It's urgent. You've got to have everything packed. You've got to be prepared to lose everything you can't carry. We've got to move it, move it. Moses is telling them there's a wonderful future for them. In a promised land far away, a land they've never seen. But they know that between here and there, there's a vast desert full of dangers. There's the Red Sea to cross. Well, can't they wait until they've prepared the equipment that they're going to need for the desert? No, says Moses, you've just got to feed on the lamb and then set out into the unknown. Do you see, Moses has to go to the Israelites. And he's got to persuade them of those three things. You're in desperate danger. The only way of safety is by sheltering under the blood of the lamb. And you've got to be prepared to get out of Egypt now without delay. And if they ask him, well, why? Why should we believe you? The only reason he can give is God has said it. And everything has got that God has said before has come true, and so will this. You know, when Moses goes to the Israelites to tell them what's going to happen and what they should do, he doesn't know what sort of reaction he's going to get from them, does he? They're already fairly sick of Moses. Every time he's gone to Pharaoh, things have got worse for them. They could simply laugh at him. They could simply get angry with him. They could refuse to do as he says. But he's still got to go, believing that there's a future, that God is going to move his chosen people to obey his word, believing that the invisible God is going to be with him as he speaks. Moses has got to go and persuade them to keep this Passover. Moses only got one advantage when he speaks to the Israelites. It's this: he really believes what he's saying. He really believes that God is going to bring about that terrible judgment. He really believes that there's no way of escape except the bloody sacrifice. He really believes that they've got to leave Egypt now without delay or they're lost. If they don't do it this night, they never will do it. Moses isn't an eloquent speaker. He knows that. But the fact that he really believes is going to give his words an eloquence. When they hear Moses speaking, they're going to say, well, I know he believes it. Those of you who are Christians, do you believe it? Do you believe that disaster is on the way? Utter disaster. For every person who is outside of Christ. Do you believe that there is an everlasting hell from which there is no escape? And that the Lord Jesus is going to say to unrepentant sinners, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire. Do you believe that? Do you believe that disaster is coming closer every day? Do you believe that there's only one way of escape from the disaster? The only place where people can be safe from the disaster that's coming is sheltering under the blood of the Lamb, covered by the atoning sacrifice of Jesus, the innocent substitute who has died in the place of the guilt. People who shelter themselves in him will be safe. There's no other place of safety. Do you believe that this matter is urgent? Do you believe that people have to turn their back on this world and on the things of this world, and that they've got to make this their great priority to set out, strengthened by Jesus Christ, on that pilgrimage to heaven? Do you believe those things? Well, if you believe them,
then you have got to tell them to other people. You have got to persuade your family. You've got to persuade your relatives. You've got to persuade the people you mix with week by week. And if you really believe them, then they will see that you really believe them. If faith is there, breaking out in your life and in your words, if it's obvious that you really believe in the invisible God who's going to bring this judgment, and you really believe in the great future realities, then people will see. People will hear. People will know. Moses, by faith, instituted that Passover. By faith, he did persuade that vast company of people to hide under the blood of the Lamb, to leave Egypt, to set out into the wilderness, to head for the land of promise. By faith, he did it. By faith, we read in verse 29, the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land. Moses communicated his faith to them. Extraordinary that they were willing to step out between those walls of water. Moses, what a challenge he had to share his faith with all those Israelites. What a challenge we have to make our Christ known to the world.